I think the tweet storm was notable because he had not tweeted anything like that during the entire overseas trips. He had been very on message. The tweets were clearly kind of planned out. And a lot of his White House staff was frankly thrilled that the president had not gone on his Twitter rants.
Many of his aides are thinking, you're back home and you're back at it again, Mr. President.
You know, some people upload pictures of their vacation onto Facebook. He gets back on Twitter
on Twitter. Well, you know, I mean, Scott, just going back to Secretary Kelly's point that this is not that unusual, what Kushner was reportedly trying to do. I mean, can't there be some value to back-channel diplomatic communication? I think back to President Obama, for example, when he was trying to reboot the U.S. relationship with Cuba. Didn't he sort of have some back-channel communications with the Vatican?
Oh, certainly. And I think back channels do play a key role in diplomacy. The difference here is that the Obama administration was in office when that was happening. This Kushner proposal came during the transition. Of course, a president-elect and his staff have to talk to other countries. Typically, that's done with and through the State Department. We already saw that the Trump transition was doing things a lot differently, kind of fielding these calls from foreign leaders without any notes or briefing from the State Department. This seems to be another example of that. Again, the key question is, why didn't Kushner want the U.S. government to be aware of these conversations? I think that's something we're all going to be asking questions a lot going forward.
Okay, well, another thing we're going to be asking a lot of questions about going forward is the big Paris climate agreement. So President Trump is back from this foreign trip. He made that stop in Europe, where this question of whether the United States is going to pull out of that climate accord is right in front of us. Do we have any idea what the president might say?
We're not sure yet. I mean, it was interesting at the G7. You had six of the countries issue a statement supporting the Paris Climate Agreement and the United States abstaining from that statement. The White House officials say that President Trump has an open mind about this, that he was listening to other leaders when he was in Italy and Brussels. But I think this decision has really essentially already been made. And that's because President Trump has directed the EPA to begin dismantling the regulations that were the main way the U.S. was going to meet its goals, largely by shifting away from coal and toward renewable energy. So really, that decision has kind of already been made by the Trump administration.
Well, work this through with me if you can. We have this big international agreement. If the U.S. backed out of it, I mean, would that have a big impact on this agreement and its goals?
For sure. I think most climate experts say that the Paris Agreement doesn't go far enough to begin with. And along with China, the U.S. is one of the world's top carbon dioxide emitters. So if the U.S. says it's not going to meet these reductions, lower its carbon footprint along with other countries, that would certainly slow down the agreement. I think the upside is that either way, the U.S. likely is going to be making progress over the coming decades. That shift from coal to natural gas to solar to wind, it's basically happening anyway because of the market at this point. And on top of that, you have big states like California, a lot of big cities saying, regardless of what the federal government does, we're going to keep trying to lower our carbon footprints.
Scott, thanks for chatting this morning.
Thank you.
That is Scott Detrow from NPR's Politics team.
When a member of the U.S. Armed Forces is killed in combat, someone must tell the family back home. And that duty falls to a person called a family liaison. Many people have seen that moment in the movies, the dress uniform, the knock at a mother's door. Some people have lived the experience. And then there are people who wait for any news, people whose loved ones went missing in action. When a missing Marine is finally found, the notification is done by Hattie Johnson, who let NPR's Arun Roth join her on a recent trip to Minden, Nevada.
The initial phone call is always difficult. Sometimes when Hattie Johnson is reaching out to family to tell them their loved one's remains have been found, it's been a half century since they've heard from the Marine Corps.
They are suspicious if we who we say we are. So sometimes they will say, well, give me some information and I'll call you back. Others just hang up.
But she says after the initial shock, almost all are happy to hear from her and want to know all of the details. Lieutenant George Stanley Busa's daughter, Geraldine Heiss, whom we're visiting today, had never heard from the Marine Corps before Johnson's call. She was just a baby when her father was killed in action in Guadalcanal in 1943.
And these are your father's awards and decorations that he's entitled to?
He received the Silver Star for his fighting on Guadalcanal.
Along with the medals, Johnson has brought a binder thick with documents and photos tracking Busa's life and death in the military.
Up until July 1943, he was a gunnery sergeant, and he was field promoted in July 1943 to a second lieutenant and given the title of platoon commander.
Moving through the binder, Johnson provides the best narrative she can of George Busa's final days.
And you'll see the maps in here. He was fighting on Red Beach 3, and you'll see in the footnotes.
It's not clear exactly when Busa died, but it was in the midst of a particularly brutal three-day battle.
And swim across. In most cases, they had to swim about 600 yards to shore through heavy Japanese fire.
With a U.S. Navy mortician at her side, Johnson goes through the full details of the death report, including photographs of the skeleton.
According to the historical data in Medical Examiner, your father's injury was in his face, up to his up in his upper body, ballistic wound to his upper body. So you'll notice most of his teeth are missing. What they do have is one tooth in his mandible, in his lower jaw. And, of course, almost all of his skeletal remains are there.
Johnson says this is usually the most difficult part of the briefing.
I mean, she's never met her father, and this is the first time she's met him, and this is what she gets, you know. She gets his skeletal remains. But sometimes when people look at the skeletal remains, that's when the emotions start pouring out during the briefing.
The hardest cases, she says, involve POWs or Marines who may have been abused before being killed.
And just trying to explain to the family the torture I would get, you know, it was just emotional to me, and I would have to stop. And so in some cases, you know, it does get really emotional for family members.
For Geraldine Heiss, who never knew her father, the feelings are less strained. It seemed he would have died quickly from his wound in a campaign that became the turning point for the war in the Pacific. And the binder holds precious letters from her mother, a window into her own past. Heiss is grateful for all of it.
It's wonderful, and I think that it's really terrific what they went through to verify that his remains were his. And just it's a wonderful thing that these people are doing.
The briefing ended the same way it would have if Busa had died in combat last week, the signing of forms and running through funeral options. The family decided to go with a burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Marine Corps Second Lieutenant George Stanley Busa will be laid to rest there with full military honors later this year. Arun Roth, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And on this Monday, Memorial Day, it is 8:18. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for beginning your day with us, and don't go anywhere. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. If you've been out and about on the Fox River this weekend, in some parts, especially towards the north, you may have noticed that it's a different color. Find out why from WPR's Patty Murray in a couple of minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Is proud to promote free community events. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Syrian government is objecting to U.S.-led airstrikes on an ISIS-held town. As NPR's Allison Muse reports, a human rights group says they've killed dozens of civilians.
The UN human rights chief says the world is ignoring the price paid by civilians in ISIS territory. U.S.-backed Syrian forces are pushing toward the ISIS stronghold Raqqa. Activists say the U.S.-led coalition is dropping leaflets, warning regime troops not to approach its partners as they press separate anti-ISIS offensives.
President Trump will be at Arlington National Cemetery this morning, taking part in the traditional Memorial Day observance. The president is back from his first overseas trip as commander-in-chief. It included a NATO summit in Brussels and a G7 summit in Sicily. Later this week, the president meets with Vietnam's prime minister at the White House. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Vietnam is considered an important ally to the U.S. in Southeast Asia, and the two leaders are expected to discuss ways to deepen their cooperation. They might be talking trade. They could also discuss Vietnam's territorial dispute with China in the South China Sea. The U.S. doesn't take a position in that dispute, though it is committed to preserving an important commercial shipping lane.
There is no trading today on Wall Street because of the Memorial Day holiday. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Memorial Day boaters on the Fox River may have noticed an odd color on the water. The DNR put a yellow dye in the water to track an invasive fish. Patty Murray reports.
The round goby is a small fish that feeds on the eggs of native species. It's been found in Little Lake Butamore, and the concern is it could migrate into the Lake Winnebago system. Rob McClellan is a DNR field supervisor.
They can be from an inch or two long up to maybe 6 inches, but they aren't really strong swimmers, so if there's a good current coming through the pipes, they might not be able to navigate them, but we just need to look into this more.
The DNR applied the dye near the Menasha Lock on the Fox River. It's closed because of the goby. DNR pilots tracked the dye path this weekend to see if water and potentially gobies are getting through old pipes. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
President Donald Trump's spending plan for 2018 includes $77.6 million for operation and maintenance of Great Lakes shipping channels and related infrastructure. The budget proposes $38 million for navigation, hydropower, and recreation projects at the Sioux Locks. It seeks smaller sums for navigation or flood risk management at other locations, including Duluth, Minnesota, Fox River, and Green Bay, Wisconsin. There's a chance of rain showers throughout the day today. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabbage, providing more than 100,000 businesses with ongoing access to a line of credit of up to $150,000. Learn more at cabbage.com/NPR or 855-CABBAGE. That's Cabbage with a K. From Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews, compare prices, and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Fidelity Investments, taking a personal, dedicated approach to wealth planning to help clients build, grow, and preserve their family's wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Today, In Your Health, the perils of self-diagnosing adult ADHD.
First, a way to stop infections by being a little less friendly. Infections in the hospital in particular are a serious and potentially life-threatening problem, and many of these infections are spread through the hands of healthcare workers.
Well, now one Los Angeles hospital is testing a new way to decrease infections by asking people not to shake hands. Anna Gorman reports.
Dr. Mark Sklansky is a self-described germaphobe. He thinks a lot about how easily germs are spread.
If I shake someone's hand, or if I am at a computer terminal, or I'm using a phone, or opening a door, or I know that my hands are now contaminated, and I need to be careful, and I need to wash my hands.
And he does. But he thinks doctors shouldn't shake hands in the first place.
We're trying to do everything we can to minimize hospital-acquired infection, except for the most obvious and easiest thing to do, in my opinion, which is to stop shaking hands.
So Sklansky decided to create a handshake-free zone. He's a pediatric cardiologist at UCLA and picked the neonatal intensive care unit, where the tiniest and sickest babies are taken care of. Sklansky and colleagues put up signs and met with staff and families. Neonatologist Joanna Parga says she liked the idea, but didn't know if it would work.
Because the handshake is so ingrained in our culture that I was wondering what patients and families would think.
They didn't ban the handshake in the NICU, but they did suggest other options. A fist bump, a smile, a bow.
And I do a lot of the shoulder touch now, or, you know, upper arm touch or shoulder touch.
Parga shows me around the unit. She points to a sink just inside the door. Beside it is a sign with a big slash through two hands shaking.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm Dr. Parga.
As she walks through the unit, she stops to say hello to a family.
Hi, nice to meet you too. I'm not going to shake your hand.
She explains the handshake-free zone.
It's to help prevent infection in the NICU. It's just another way to try to keep our babies safe.
Sklansky and others surveyed staff and parents about the change and found most people were on board, especially the families. New mom Brittany Scott stands above her son's crib. He sleeps to the sound of the babbling brook.
This is Samuel, my son.
Samuel is in the NICU because of a problem with his intestines. Scott says she'd never heard of a handshake-free zone.
So I was a little taken back by it at first, but yeah, once you really understand kind of the meaning behind it, it's great.
She knows Samuel is at risk of infection, so avoiding germs is important. Scott says now she prefers a smile to a handshake.
A smile goes a long ways in here. There's a lot of ups and downs when being a parent to a NICU baby.
Some infectious disease specialists argue that doctors don't need to stop shaking hands. They just need to scrub better. Studies show only about 40% of doctors and others comply with hospital hand washing policies. Sklansky says, why not do both?
It's not in any means to take the place of hand washing. It's actually meant to complement those efforts.
His next step is to see if handshake-free zones will reduce infections. He's convinced they will. I'm Anna Gorman in Los Angeles.
She's a correspondent with Kaiser Health News.
The World Health Organization has endorsed a 6-question screening test for ADHD in adults. Now, this is catching a lot of people's attention because with symptoms like distractedness and disorganization, it can be pretty tempting to diagnose yourself or others with ADHD. But as NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports, many ADHD researchers say we shouldn't really trust any simple or quick test.
The screening test includes questions like, do you procrastinate? And appears to promise a quick and easy diagnosis. David Goodman is an ADHD specialist at Johns Hopkins University and consultant for companies that make ADHD drugs. And he says there's nothing quick or easy about diagnosing adult ADHD.
The diagnosis gets made in a clinical interview with the patient over the course of an hour or so, tracking the symptoms from childhood into adulthood.
And he says, especially in adults, docs need to make sure symptoms like distractedness, disorganization, and procrastination aren't coming from some other disorder, like anxiety. Dr. Lawrence Diller, a pediatric ADHD specialist, goes one step further, saying the basic definition of ADHD has changed multiple times.
I don't know anymore what ADHD means, literally. I believe in it, but except for extremes, in children, again, it becomes very subjective.
Making diagnosis difficult. He says diagnostic tools like the 6-question screening are potentially misleading because the symptoms they describe are so ubiquitous. Like, who isn't distracted?
In America, if your talents and temperament don't match your goals and aspirations, that the incongruity generates a series of feelings or behaviors that match quite nicely the diagnostic criteria.
Which makes ADHD meds very popular among Americans. The U.S. is by far the largest consumer of ADHD drugs in the world, and the market is still growing. Alan Schwartz is a former investigative reporter for the New York Times and the author of the book ADHD Nation. He says there's something more sinister at play as well.
The 6-question screening instrument that was endorsed by the World Health Organization was devised by doctors with a very long history in ADHD. And these are generally men who have been enriched by the pharmaceutical industry in order to churn out research and churn out things like this that expand the ADHD market.
So what options are available for adults who are diagnosed with ADHD? There are amphetamines, like Adderall. Adults are generally prescribed extended-release versions of those pills because they're more difficult to abuse. Antidepressants have also been shown to help with impulsivity and hyperactivity. And there are options without drugs, like cognitive behavioral therapy. The upshot? Your best bet is to talk to a specialist about what treatment works best for you. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing help with bathing, medication reminders, and Alzheimer's and dementia care to keep seniors at home. HomeInstead.com/NPR. And from Novo Nordisk, working to defeat diabetes for more than 90 years through prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. More at novonordisk.us.
This is NPR News.
One man has made it his mission to ensure that the graves of American service members are legible.
If you were just walking or driving by, you would just see a weathered, very dirty monument and would have no idea who it belonged to.
He has cleaned mold and mildew off more than 600 gravestones. I'm Ari Shapiro. We hear his story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That plus all the news of the day on All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up later this hour on Morning Edition, hear from a free speech advocate who says that freedom of speech on college campuses has been under attack lately. That story in less than 10 minutes. It's 8:30 on this Memorial Day Monday. You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin news, Wisconsin Democrats say they're increasingly optimistic about their chances of knocking off Republican Governor Scott Walker next year, even though a top-tier candidate has yet to emerge. Plus, Democrats are still recovering from a devastating 2016 election. Democrats are gathered for the Wisconsin State Party Convention. They say liberals are energized in opposition both to President Donald Trump and Republicans closely tied with him like Walker. Walker's approval rating has been below 50% since early 2014. But the Democrats' recent track record has not been good. The party is still trying to recover from Trump being the first Republican presidential candidate to carry Wisconsin since 1984. Walker has faced challengers but has won three elections since 2010. Authorities have released the names of four people killed in a crash near Cornell in northwestern Wisconsin. The Chippewa County Sheriff's Office named them yesterday as 23-year-old Michaela Toski, 21-year-old Raven Ellen, and 36-year-old Jonathan Jorgensen, all of Eau Claire, and 46-year-old Christine Comer of Medford. The passengers were in a minivan that collided with a pickup truck. This is WPR.
Support for WPR's marketing and promotions comes from the Harold A. Engel Memorial Communications Arts Internship Fund, helping WPR employ a graduate fellow from the Wisconsin School of Business Bolt's MBA in the Arts program.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. Join their summer cigar events happening every other Thursday on the patio. Take advantage of great deals, enjoy a top-rated cigar, and relax with friends. Visit andreasgifts.com for the complete schedule. Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
There will be scattered rain showers through the day and isolated thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 50s to lower 60s, and tonight the chance those rain showers will continue with temperatures in the 40s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Rackspace, a managed cloud company with more than 3,000 cloud engineers supporting businesses around the clock. Rackspace, your clouds, our expertise. Learn more at rackspace.com/expertise. From C3 IoT, providing a software platform that brings machine learning, big data, and cloud computing to industrial-scale predictive analytics and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We are in the middle of college graduation season, which is a season of high-profile commencement speeches. In 2017, some of the speeches are about speech, how we debate one another. On Friday, for example, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton told Wellesley College, her alma mater, the graduates there, that it's too easy to avoid hearing anyone who disagrees with us.
We can shut out contrary voices, avoid ever questioning our basic assumptions. Extreme views are given powerful microphones. Leaders willing to exploit fear and skepticism have tools at their disposal that were unimaginable when I graduated.
Some of the shutting out of contrary voices happens on campus. This year, planned speeches have been shut down from Berkeley, California to Vermont. Many of those kept from speaking were politically conservative. But it all bothers a man who identifies as liberal, Greg Lukianoff. He's a First Amendment lawyer and the head of an organization called Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which advocates for free speech on campus. How common is it that a speaker who's controversial or perceived as controversial is thrown off a campus or threatened with being thrown off the campus?
Overall, not that common, but it's amazing that it happens at all, given that particularly when it comes to commencement speakers, over the years, universities have become a lot more small-c conservative about who they invite. So they're already being very careful with who they invite. So the fact that in 2016, we saw 42 attempts to get speakers disinvited, both commencement and otherwise, we didn't consider that a good trend. Let's put it that way.
How do people go about attempting to disinvite speakers?
The way we distinguish is if the goal is either to get that speaker off the campus, essentially that speaker can't speak here, or to shout them down, or worst of all, of course, to engage in violence to prevent the speech from going on, like happened at Berkeley back in February.
Okay, so 42 times in 1 year, and there'll be some more this year as you tally it up.
And that was the worst year we'd seen. We have about 15 years of research on it, and we actually have the largest database on disinvitation attempts, mm-hmm. because that's really what we count, because that is how you sort of take the temperature for tolerance for listening to people you disagree with on campus.
Is this reflecting the education itself, what's happening in the classrooms?
I'm really wondering about that, because for most of my career, I've been working, fighting for defending academic freedom and free speech on campus since about 2001. And for the overwhelming majority of my career, the single best constituency for free speech on campus were the students themselves. And people are sometimes kind of surprised to hear that. And mm-hmm. I'm like, no, most of what we were fighting were administrators. It's only around 2014, 2013 that we started seeing a lot of push by students for people to be disinvited, for new speech codes and new speech restrictions.
Why don't we listen to an example where there was a speaker on campus and many people on campus disagreed with his point of view. It was the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. He went to Notre Dame in my home state of Indiana and delivered a graduation speech. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
While this institution has maintained an atmosphere of civility and open debate, far too many campuses across America have become characterized by speech codes, safe zones, tone policing, administration-sanctioned political correctness, all of which amounts to nothing less than suppression of the freedom of speech.
So Vice President Pence takes this opportunity on a campus to speak up for freedom of speech. As he's doing it, some, not all, of the graduates are standing up and walking out of the speech. And there was a Notre Dame student who tried to explain to CNN why she thought that was. Her name is Aniela Tiksinski.
The walkout was in response to the fact that members of our own community felt unwelcome, uncomfortable, and even unsafe with the invitation of Mike Pence. And so political discourse should be happening in other contexts at this campus, not at our commencement.
Okay, so let's just walk through that incident. Mike Pence speaking up for Notre Dame, but criticizing campuses in general. The students saying many of us felt unsafe. What do you make of all that?
Well, I definitely think what the students did was entirely appropriate. I've been frustrated and saddened to see in many cases students either refuse, they try to shut down events in some cases, or shout speakers down in the case of Charles Murray, in some cases in the case of Ray Kelly at Brown several years back. I do get a little worried when I hear people talking about using the word unsafe to mean basically uncomfortable. I do think that leads to problems where people sort of conflate opinions with violence. And that's something that I've been increasingly seeing on campus, that they don't make a major distinction between those two things.
Violence increasingly doesn't mean setting a fire at Berkeley to stop an event. Violence means saying words that people don't want to hear.
And that's a very bad trend. I wrote a short book called Freedom from Speech a couple of years ago. And I said, if you create a situation in which a professor, when you say you feel unsafe, they assume 9 times out of 10 you mean something more like uncomfortable, that's a very dangerous situation for people who are genuinely unsafe. Certainly, like when I was in college, if you said you were unsafe, you'd be like, oh my God, we have to call the police. What do we need to do? Watering down terms that are so central to people's actual safety is dangerous.
So you like that the students at Notre
Yes.
Dame, those who protested, found a way to speak themselves
Absolutely,
without
yeah.
actually interrupting Vice President Pence. What did you make of what Vice President Pence had to say?
I, of course, and I'm always happy when people have nice nice things to say about freedom of speech. We did chuckle a little bit, though, at the idea that Notre Dame is great on free speech. We classify them as a red light school, which means that they have at least one speech code on campus. Now, Notre Dame doesn't have to promise freedom of speech because it's a private school, but they do.
How common are speech codes, as you just called them?
So when we first started evaluating most major colleges, it was around 75% of universities maintain red light speech codes. But there have been like 60 lawsuits against speech codes since 1989. So they're now down to about 40%.
Okay.
We are seeing some actual progress on
They've
that.
Been going down. Would you describe your own politics?
Liberal atheist, as I sometimes get picked on for.
Okay, so you're being literal. Liberal atheist. As a liberal atheist, do your fellow liberals get a little upset when you criticize people who are criticizing conservatives or trying to stop conservatives from speaking on campus?
It depends on who. You know, like my oldest friends totally get it. But I will say it can be pretty exhausting to be in the middle of the culture war all the time, because it is a situation where nobody assumes good intentions on the other side. They're totally with you if it's a speaker they like, but they totally hate you if it's a speaker they don't.
So you're okay even with Charles Murray, very controversial academic, speaking on a campus?
Well, yeah, I think that we need better practice on how to listen to people, even opinions that we despise.
Greg Lukiano, thanks very much.
Thank you.
He's head of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Now, later this afternoon, on All Things Considered, we report on a region where it is genuinely unsafe to hold a minority view. Many Christians are fleeing the Middle East. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
On this Memorial Day, it is 8:41, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we'll bring you news live from NPR and WPR. And in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, a new biography celebrates the life and legacy of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gwendolyn Brooks. She was an honored figure in the Black Arts Movement and mentored a number of contemporary Black poets. Hear her story in 10 minutes.
As news breaks on Capitol Hill and way beyond Washington, NPR is busy digging into the details.
This is a failure of policy.
Eliminating the requirement to need 60 votes.
Congress may not be sure whether the FBI...
We're checking the facts, adding context and voices from all sides to help you understand how what's happening affects your life at home. Listen to All Things Considered every day.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 every day on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. French President Emmanuel Macron and Russian President Vladimir Putin are meeting today outside Paris. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley says the new French president is promising to be tough with Putin on issues including Syria and Chechnya.
Putin openly supported Macron's opponent, Marine Le Pen, in the French presidential race. But Russia is increasingly isolated on the world stage, and Putin is looking to revive relations with France. Macron will give Putin a regal welcome, but the young French president plans to take a hard line. Macron will bring up Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine and Syria, as well as human rights abuses in Chechnya.
The South Korean government says most people in that country are opposed to an agreement reached with Japan over wartime sexual slavery. Ji-hae Lee reports from Seoul.
It's the first official stance under the new president, Moon Jae-in, who's pledged to review the controversial deal. It was initially dubbed final and irreversible, despite disapproval from the victims of sexual slavery. This comes after Japanese media cited the UN Secretary General as supporting the 2015 deal.
Authorities in southern Mississippi say a man arguing with his estranged wife and her family over his children shot and killed 8 people, including a sheriff's deputy. The shootings took place at separate houses. The suspect, Willie Corey Godbolt, is facing murder charges. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Firewood restrictions remain in effect in many Wisconsin counties to prevent the spread of an invasive insect that can kill ash trees. The emerald ash borer can be found in most southern Wisconsin counties and north of Highway 29 in parts of Douglas, Sawyer, Oneida, and Door counties. Lynn Kane of the Wisconsin Master Gardeners Association says there are telltale signs when ash trees are infected.
You'll find D-shaped bore holes going into your ash tree. That's usually a good signal. Also, if you start looking at your ash tree and you have woodpeckers in the top, they're up there because the larvae are already in there.
Emerald ash borers are tiny, so people don't notice them until it's too late for the tree. It is illegal in Wisconsin to move firewood from counties infested with emerald ash borers unless it's purchased from a state-certified vendor. Attorneys have settled a lawsuit against a UW-Wisconsin Madison advisor who counseled the daughter of a woman killed in a car crash but did not tell the student he had been texting with the driver. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that the State Justice Department has settled with Megan Menglitz's lawsuit for $200,000. Menglitz's advisor, Tori Richardson, allegedly reached out to her days after Bruce Burnside killed her mother in a 2013 crash in Sun Prairie. According to the lawsuit, Richardson solicited information from her about Burnside's prosecution and the potential civil lawsuit, but never told her she had been texting with Burnside.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Farmers Insurance, committed to making the world a smarter place through shared knowledge and experience. Tales of home, car, and other insurance coverage can be found at farmers.com. From Barracuda Networks, security, data protection, and application delivery solutions for physical networks and public cloud services. Learn more at barracuda.com/products. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. For decades, the Philippines has fought an on-again, off-again separatist insurgency on its southern islands. But the newest militant group has aligned itself with ISIS. And last week, they took control of a city, Marawi, on the island of Mindanao. Reporter Michael Sullivan is there.
On the side of the road, on the outskirts of Marawi City, a small crowd peers into a ravine where eight bodies are sprawled in the jungle below. Bloodstains on the road offer a clue to what happened. Police officer Jamel Mangangdang.
Early in the morning, some of these concerned citizens report to my checkpoint. There is eight bodies in that place.
He calls over one of his men, who hands him a crumpled cigarette.
You're showing me nine shell casings. That means these people were executed here.
Yes.
Civilians executed by the militants, according to the armed forces. Militants who've also taken at least a dozen hostages, including a Catholic priest, in the past week. The city is home to more than 200,000 people. The provincial vice governor, Mamintal Adiong Jr., says most have fled.
Ang estimate lang natin is 80% to 90%.
80% to 90% of the population has left, he says. There is no power, no water, and not a lot of food for those who've chosen to stay, like Abu Qadir Kamama and his family.
I do not want to leave my residence.
Are you afraid for your children that this fighting will get worse?
Simply, of course.
When do you think it will end?
I don't know. When will be the end of these troubles?
Many parts of Marawi City are abandoned. The only things moving, animals left behind, and heavily armed Philippine soldiers moving cautiously as they try to clear the militants block by block. The soldiers are edgy, and with good reason. Nearly a dozen have been killed since the fighting began. Their commander is General Carlito Galvez.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have to understand the danger of urban fighting.
Speaking to reporters over the weekend, General Galvez said snipers can pin down an entire battalion, which helps explain why it's taking so long. Even as tough-talking President Rodrigo Duterte, who's from the island of Mindanao, has vowed to crush the IS-linked militancy here, an effort that includes the use of air power. Attack aircraft and helicopters have been pounding militant positions for days. Between that and the fire started by the militants, many worry about what will be left when it's over. Asrina Makambanding is a 17-year-old displaced person now staying in nearby Iligan.
What home are we going to go home when this ends? If our home is still intact because of the airstrikes launched by the government and etc.
So are you worried about your house being burned down by these militants or being bombed by the military or both?
Both.
There's also concern about the safety of civilians still trapped inside militant-controlled areas and growing unease here with the military's progress and tactics. Professor Melba Ang Ni is not one of those critics. She lays the blame for all of it on the militants linked to the Islamic State.
If those people who are actually fighting, as they said, they're fighting for Islam, I don't think their way is Islamic. I think they have another style, which is actually giving this devastation for the private citizens.
She says there's no place for IS in Mindanao, and she says the ones who started all this are just criminals. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Marawi City.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Morning Edition continues next here on WPR.
Support comes from the Racine Theater Guild, now presenting Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Tickets are going fast. Order online at racinetheater.org or call 633-4218. By demand, a fourth weekend of performances have been added June 2nd through the 4th.
Book Testimony. WPR is proud to promote free community events. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
Stay tuned. Morning Classics begins in just about 20 minutes with host Stephanie Elkins. Stephanie, what's on the playlist today?
Well, it's Memorial Day, so there's music for Memorial Day. And we're going to start with a piece by Maurice Ravel that honors some of his friends that were killed in World War I.
Well, that sounds like a lovely tribute.
It is. It's lively music. It's not really depressing. It's gorgeous music. Honors those friends.
Well, I'll make sure to stay tuned once I'm off the air. Stephanie Elkins with Morning Classics in about 20 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio. There will be scattered rain showers throughout the day today in Wisconsin. Highs will be in the upper 50s and mid-60s.
Support for WPR comes from WM Concerts, presenting singer-songwriter Donovan, June 8th at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee, and June 11th at Capitol Theater in Madison. Tickets are at WMConcerts.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, back on 2nd Avenue and Plaza Douay for the warm weather season. Featuring Savino's Brick Oven Pizza, personal-sized pizzas made and baked in a wood fire oven while you wait. The market is open Saturdays from 9 till 2.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Gwendolyn Brooks would have turned 100 next month. She was the first African-American to win a Pulitzer Prize. And on the centennial of her birth, a new biography of the late poet is out this week. Here's Karen Grigsby-Bates of our Code Switch team.
In 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks got the news of her Pulitzer Prize for poetry while sitting in the growing gloom of her living room. In a 1986 interview with the Library of Congress, Brooks confided she was in the dark because her electric bill hadn't been paid. So, amidst her jubilation about the Pulitzer, she worried about what would happen when word of her honor became public and the press descended upon her.
The next day, reporters came, photographers came with cameras, and I was absolutely petrified. I wasn't going to say anything about the electricity. I knew that when they tried to attach their cameras and all, nothing was going to happen.
Turned out, the photographers were able to plug in their lights because someone, Brooks never knew who, quietly paid the bill. That, to a certain extent, was Gwendolyn Brooks' life. Sometimes financially strapped, always artistically sublime. In poet Angela Jackson's new biography, A Surprised Queenhood in the New Black Sun, The Life and Legacy of Gwendolyn Brooks, Jackson says even before her award, Gwendolyn Brooks was well known by many African Americans because she appeared in the Chicago Defender, a legendary black newspaper.
She published regularly from 1938 to about 1945 in the Chicago Defender, and the Defender was read not just by black people in Chicago, but by black people all throughout the South where it was distributed.
This new honor, Jackson says, now drew the attention of white America as well.
As with the Pulitzer for anyone, her notoriety increased, and the fact that she was the first African American to be awarded the Pulitzer made her notoriety go through the roof.
Brooks' collections, like A Street in Bronzeville, The Bean Eaters, and In the Mecca, describe black Chicago, its landmarks, its customs, its people, in recognizable detail. She wrote about people not normally visible in the poetry world. Nora Brooks Blakely says this didn't surprise anyone who knew her mother.
It was definitely important for her to speak about the people that she lived around, among, with. But fundamentally, Mama was an observer.
It was that quick eye that was the catalyst for one of Gwendolyn Brooks' most famous poems, which she reads here.
We real cool, the pool players, seven at the golden shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Other work, like her Pulitzer Prize-winning volume Annie Allen, described the life of a brown-skinned black girl in cadence and imagery that showed Brooks' mastery of classic poetic structure. It put her in the company of poets like Robert Frost and William Carlos Williams. But, daughter Nora Blakely recalls, there was still struggle.
I remember a lot of meals of beans and chicken wings before chicken wings got gourmet and popular, when chicken wings were just the cheapest part of the chicken.
Brooks and her husband, Henry Blakely, raised Nora and her older brother, Hank, in a home rich with books and music and intellectual discussions. Brooks' finances wouldn't change until the mid-60s, when she began to teach poetry and writing at several colleges. Nora Blakely remembers one year her mother taught at three colleges concurrently.
That Christmas, suddenly the Christmas presents changed, and she just had a happy little fit where she only got presents that year for people from Marshall Fields and C.D. Peacock.
Born in Topeka, Kansas in 1917, Gwendolyn Elizabeth Brooks became a Chicagoan when she was 5 weeks old. She grew up on the city's south side with thousands of black residents who had migrated out of the south near the end of World War I. At age seven, she was making her own books of stories and poems. As a teen, Harlem Renaissance poets James Weldon Johnson and Langston Hughes mentored her. In turn, she would spend her life encouraging aspiring young poets, including Chicago poet Haki Matabudi, who met her in the early 1960s.
Like so many young poets at that time, was pretty much in awe of her craft, her work, and her commitment to her community.
Matabudi, who first published under his birth name, Donnell Lee, came to prominence during the Black Arts Movement, a decade in the mid-60s to 70s that focused on black self-expression. He said he and a number of what Brooks fondly called the riotous young people would meet at her small home and argue poetry and politics passionately.
Our poetry changed, and our poetry changed.
And it wasn't only the poetry that changed.
One day she showed up. We walked in. She had a scarf on her head, and then she took the scarf off her head, and she had a natural. She had a natural hairdo.
For a proper middle-aged black woman at the time, it was a bold move. Brooks made other bold moves. She left her mainstream publisher for Black Presses. Her old friend Haki Matabudi heads Chicago's Third World Press, which has published her books for the past several years.
She never took royalties. She said, you know, just use the money to build a press.
Gwendolyn Brooks believed in building black institutions and put her modest money where her mouth was. Nora Brooks Blakely says while her mother enjoyed nice things, she considered them occasional enhancements, not necessities. Instead, she created and funded poetry prizes to encourage others and gave money to people who needed the time and space to write.
I am constantly amazed by the number of people who come up to me and talk to me about the impact that Mama had on their lives.
A conference on poetry was established in her name at Chicago State University. Biographer Angela Jackson.
One year, Toni Morrison was speaker, and she at great length talked about Miss Brooks' influence on her writing, that she was able to write because of Gwendolyn Brooks.
Several schools were named after her. Students, actors, and spoken word artists often recite We Real Cool in tribute to this quiet, generous poet. On June 7th, Chicago will hold a birthday celebration for Gwendolyn Brooks, a very American poet who elevated the stories of ordinary African Americans with her extraordinary skill. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
And you can listen to Morning Edition from 5 until 9 every weekday or whenever you want to with the free WPR app. There are always stories at WPR.org, including the top one this morning, reporting that close to 90% of Wisconsin milk will be free of the growth hormone RBST in 2018.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, where all biopsies are reviewed by a team of cancer pathologists to determine an appropriate treatment plan. In healthcare, experience matters. UWHealth.org/second opinion.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, from May 3rd to May 28th, Lemon Street Gallery features the work of three artists, Bob Schnack, Vicki Ridgway, and Melissa Pearson. Gallery hours are Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, 11 to 6 p.m., and Thursday and Sundays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.